Hey, it's Benjamin. So today, we have a story from Afghanistan. I started working on this episode back before the Taliban took over the country in August. This has, of course, changed a lot about the security situation there, and you'll hear about that at the end of the show. But even before that, there are a lot of challenges to making people in Afghanistan safer. Our story today is about an app that is changing how the country works on a basic level by solving really important problems. Problems like holding governments accountable and keeping people safe. But across the world from Afghanistan, here in New York City, I noticed that the same story is playing out on a very different level. On the street level, to be precise. It's a Monday evening in New York, and I'm riding my bike back to my apartment after meeting some friends. The Manhattan skyline shimmers on the dark waters of the Hudson, and all feels at peace in the world. But then...
Oh, like five mice. I think they were probably rats. They were big enough to be rats, for sure.
I see a huge group of rats. I almost run one over with a back tire of my bike.
Oh, there's another. Literally one more. Yep.
Now, I know rats are a New York thing, but still, growing up in Colorado, my brain automatically thinks, wow, rats? Isn't the city supposed to take care of this? Which I know is the most not New York City thing I could ever say. But it turns out, after asking around a bit, that even people from here are saying, there's too many rats, even for us. Aren't our taxes supposed to pay to keep them out? I talked about this with Trisha. So... I mean, the rats this summer have been, like, so bad. Have they always been like this in New York?
So bad. No, I have lived here for 4 years now, and before the pandemic, they weren't that bad. You'd still see an occasional rat here and there.
Yeah.
But now, it's terrible. There are rats everywhere, and you can't walk without being scared of stepping on one.
Trisha lived here before the pandemic and thinks the rat situation has changed a lot. But I wanted to see if other people felt the same way. So I hopped on the neighborhood app next door. It sounds like for some people, the rats are more than just an inconvenience. This is what Isha from Central Harlem said. I asked Trisha to read what she wrote on Nextdoor.
A family of mice commandeered my kitchen last week, to the point that I couldn't even watch TV in my living room because of all the commotion.
And Sarah from Hamilton Heights explained that
the rats were literally starving to death during the strict lockdowns, but now they're back and, quote, stronger than ever.
And finally, Steve from the Upper West Side complained.
You are not alone. The rats have free reign. I have lived in the neighborhood for 40 years and I don't remember it ever being this bad. Our building uses an exterminator and you can smell the dead rats. Oh, but there are plenty more to take their place. I would think the city could do more.
So it's not just me. Rats are a real problem in New York, especially after COVID. And like Steve said, the city seems to be doing next to nothing to solve it. Just listen to this other post I found on Nextdoor from Ira on the Upper West Side.
You can either wait for your electeds to do something or you can get yourself some Protecta bait stations and some peanut butter and check them once a day. I did this until Parks took away my bait stations. I got over 200 that way.
So not only are elected officials barely doing anything to solve the rat problem, they're actively stymieing regular residents' efforts. It's absolutely maddening. I had to talk to Ira.
Hi. Are you Ira?
Yes.
Hi, I'm Benjamin.
Hi, Benjamin.
Oh, you interrupted something. Sorry.
Oh, no
you.
Worries.
I met Ira in Riverside Park near his apartment. He described rat trapping as his hobby to pass the time.
So the only reason I trap rats, I do it for sport.
Like just to count them up?
Yeah,
as many
yeah.
As possible.
Yeah, I like that.
We walked around the park, and he showed me his go-to trapping spots.
This is the dog run.
Okay.
I had a bunch of them up by that other garden,
okay.
And Parks took them away and replaced them with purple flags.
Really?
So Ira started trapping rats as something to do, but also because the city wasn't doing enough to solve this problem. Like those Nextdoor posts said, calling the public service number often doesn't work, so Ira took the problem into his own hands.
Rats don't like dogs.
But then, the city just took all his stuff. So what do you do when rats commandeer your kitchen, take over your streets? Who do you talk to? Who do you complain to? who is there to fix it?
I don't know.
The city's not going to do it, even though it's their job. Maybe normal neighbors like Ira will, but the city bureaucracy is throwing a wrench in his efforts too. And it's one thing to be uncomfortable in Manhattan, living with decaying rats in your walls. Maybe it's unsafe, it's definitely unhealthy, but complaining about rats in New York City, in one of the safest countries in the world, can seem like a ridiculous privilege. But it's not just Manhattanites who struggle to make sure their needs are met when those in charge fall short. It's a challenge faced by people everywhere. And that's where our story today, in Afghanistan, comes in.
Keeping the government accountable, the way that we're able to do it with transparency and keeping people informed, is that no matter what happens in the city, we're going to get that information out to the people. And no one can control that.
Today, how a woman and her tech startup is empowering people to take their safety into their own hands. When safety is about more than just rats on the street. When it's a matter of life and death.
Welcome to People Place Power, where we explore big questions around activism through the eyes of changemakers around the world. I'm Trisha Mukherjee.
And I'm Benjamin Swift. So, in most parts of the US, things are relatively stable. Sure, this country still faces a ton of problems, everything from houselessness to environmental pollution to, yes, even rat infestations. But for the most part, we don't have to worry about an air raid raining bombs down on us or a landmine exploding in a neighbor's backyard. And still, here, it's hard to keep governments accountable to our needs. But in Afghanistan, because of decades of foreign invasions and civil war, the possibility of drone strikes and IED explosions is all too real. This violence isn't what defines this place, but it is where this story begins. One day a few years ago, Sarah Wahidi was walking home from work in Kabul when something life-changing happened.
I was walking home one day from work, and I was just turning the street towards my apartment, and I heard someone say something like, his vest isn't working, his vest isn't working. And I put two together and I said, vest, not working. Okay, it has to be a suicide attack. So in that moment, I literally ran for dear life, and I was able to make it into my apartment before the first bomb. And the first bomb exploded, and I saw it kind of like shook. And it just engulfed my entire street. And then the second one, and then the third one. So from 11 a.m. until 11 p.m., it was just attacks, attacks, attacks. And the next morning, I was so obviously shocked, and I was concerned about my community members. And I was asking a taxi driver, where can I get information about the police office in this area? Where can I get information about electricity, about sanitation? Our roads are blocked. The mess needs to be cleaned up from the explosions. And everyone that I asked, no one knew how to contact city services. No one knew how to contact the city representatives.
So there were two problems here. It was really unsafe, and no one was systematically doing anything to improve the situation. So what do you do when the government that's supposed to protect you has other plans? You take matters into your own hands. For Sarah, that meant founding a civic engagement startup called Ehtisab.
That's where Ehtisab came in, was we need a platform where people can send in reports, send in issues, and that can be connected to city officials. And the city officials can be accountable for that response.
Okay, so for Sarah, that moment was really transformative for her. And it might end up being transformative for Afghanistan, too. But to peel back a little, Sarah actually spent most of her life in North America, not Afghanistan. One early memory in particular is especially vivid for her.
So everything my mom had, her Afghan passport, documentation, anything, she just threw it in Niagara Falls. And it was a very cinematic moment, but she just threw it. And she always tells me this. She's always like, I threw everything in the water and we came here to live with the clothes on our backs.
Sarah and her family had been living in shelters between New York City and Buffalo.
The few memories that I have of childhood are in that homeless shelter because it was so frightening. There were so many people. It was overcrowded. It was very frightening. You know, there were cockroaches everywhere.
And when they finally got approved for asylum in Canada, they decided it would be safest to show up without any possessions.
It was so frightening for them. They were like, you know, if we have anything, they might ask us, they might question us, and it's just better to come with nothing, because that's still something that refugees truly believe in, that throw away the iPhone, throw away whatever you have, because if you're going to claim for asylum, you literally have to come with nothing.
So Sarah, her mom, and her brother cross the border into Canada and start a new life.
So for the first, I guess, 8-9 years of my life, I had no idea what this word Afghan meant or what this culture meant, other than the fact that I spoke my native language at home and ate food. That was really it.
She grows up in a small town outside Vancouver. It's worlds away from Afghanistan.
It was a very small town, predominantly white. People, when they first met me, it wasn't like, oh, are you Indian? Are you Mexican? There was even the notion of an Asian being in that area was just not a thing. So I grew up being told or asked, you know, are you Mexican? Are you South American? You know, so that was what my norm was. I hadn't met an Afghan until I was in grade 4, I think, and he was a refugee.
So growing up in her little town, returning to Afghanistan was pretty much out of the question for Sarah, especially since she doesn't remember much from her early childhood there. And her mom experienced a lot of trauma growing up with so much violence under the Taliban. She definitely wasn't planning on going back.
I didn't have any interest. I think it's because my mother had seen so much trauma there. Afghanistan has been debilitated by 40 to 50 years of war, just constant war. And I remember very little from Afghanistan. I think it's also because it was such a simple life. You know, there was not a lot of movement. I mean, children would kind of stay in their homes or that street that they lived on because of the instability, because it was so unsafe. I mean, if you had a home, you stayed in that home. So it was just, you know, stay home, keep out of anyone's business. And it was a very unstable time.
So after her family moved to Canada, Sarah graduated high school and headed off to college at the University of British Columbia. She studied political science there, but it didn't quite do it for her.
I thought I would do political science. I thought that was going to be my career. And I really hated it, to be honest. I just didn't like the fact that, you know, obviously with human rights, there's a human component. Whereas with political science, there's just so much theory. There's just so much of, I think this, not I think this and I'm going to do this with this information. Because a lot of the political scientists that we read, it's mostly theoretical. You know, you're thinking about why the world is a certain way, the different types of political spectrums. And I just didn't want that to be my life. I didn't want to tell people what to do. I didn't want to tell people this is my opinion.
While she wasn't yet sure quite what she did want to do, growing up in Canada, Sarah thought a lot about what it means to be a country of immigrants.
You know, the Canadian saying is that Canada is like a mosaic, so we welcome everyone and they kind of stick together with the differences, whereas the U.S. is like a melting pot. You know, there's this American ideal and America wants you to become that American ideal.
And that was just the foundation she needed to do work back in her home country, back in Afghanistan. And after a few different jobs, that's just where she ended up, working in the Afghan president's office under President Ashraf Ghani. There, Sarah worked on all sorts of projects relating to migration and social development. This was back when Afghanistan had democratically elected public officials. And in addition to a president, the country also had a CEO.
So if I was the advisor to the president on social development, there was a shadow of me who is the advisor to the CEO on social development. And I'd have to go to the shadow person and then they'd have to come to me. And that's why it was so difficult to get anything through.
And though her work was important, she felt disconnected from the people she was supposed to be serving.
We very rarely spoke or worked with Afghans in our work. And I know that it was because we were at the presidential level that, you know, you obviously don't get to work on the front line as much. But I felt very lost because there wasn't any sort of citizen engagement. And I felt very isolated from people, especially when you're creating policy. I find that some of the most holistic and most successful policies regarding social development is when you're working with people, is when you're researching, is when you're serving, is when you're discussing with them. And that's something that I struggled with greatly, was why don't we have greater roles for citizens, especially in a country that is tribalistic, that is so community oriented. We need to engage the community more. And that was something that I realized really needed to be focused on in Afghanistan, was engaging the citizenry more in policymaking.
These were the thoughts going through Sarah's head in 2018, when she was sheltering from a suicide bombing. Her neighborhood was in ruins. She didn't know what to do or how to contact city officials to begin cleaning up the problem. And she literally worked for the president. After the break, how Sarah began enacting her vision for civic engagement from outside the presidential palace.
People Place Power is supported by New York Justice for Our Neighbors, a New York City-based nonprofit dedicated to welcoming immigrants with compassion, dignity, and love. I invited Executive Director Paul Fleck to the studio to learn more about New York Justice for Our Neighbors' work. So, Paul, can you tell me a little bit about what JFON does?
Sure. Justice for Our Neighbors is a national organization that provides free legal representation for clients from all around the world.
Can you tell me why JFON's work is important today?
Well, navigating the immigration legal justice system is incredibly daunting, and it's probably the most complex area of the law that exists. Lawyers cost a lot. A lot of times, the lawyers who practice in this area are not as competent as they could be. Sometimes there are even fraudulent providers, such as notarios, that take people's money and then actually put them in more danger. You combine that with language barriers, cultural barriers, it's very daunting.
And how is New York Justice for Our Neighbors unique in what you do?
It is unique in the way we offer these services, especially the faith-based initiative through which we do it, by offering legal clinics in church basements and turning them into mini law offices for intaking clients. It's unique in the legal services field.
Would you be able to tell me briefly about just one case that NYJFON worked on that stands out to you?
I think about something that just happened in August when a client of TJ Mills, our managing attorney, he was able to reunite them with their children from Benin. They'd been separated from their children for 16 long years, all six children, and TJ was able to effectuate them meeting with each other at JFK and coming reunited. They were just so thrilled to be able to see each other once again.
Over the past year, I've witnessed the power of JFON's work. Many of their clients call the attorneys miracle workers, and it's true. Every day, this organization makes miracles happen. If you'd like to help immigrants reunite with their families, find dignified work, and feel welcomed in the United States, please consider supporting NYJFON at www.ny-jfon.org.
All right, we're back. When Sarah was caught in those explosions, she felt entirely helpless. But if the same thing were to happen to her today, with the work that her startup Etisab is doing, her experience would be way different.
And no one knew that I was in that situation. I had only called my boss and I was like, the situation happened. I'm freaking out. I don't know what to do. And at that time, I felt very lonely because I had enough capacity to call my boss, but I didn't have the capacity to call my mom or to call, you know, one of my best friends. Like I was so scared. I was completely traumatized. And now the difference is that you know that there is a group of people whose only job it is to inform you of what's going on in your area. Like we have an office with four desks, like four, you know, data entry analysts who literally sit there and are just looking for reports constantly. Like that's their job. And that feeling basically says to you that whenever something happens and whenever we can verify that to you or to your loved ones, we will send out that information. So in my scenario now, what could have happened is, you know, someone would have taken a photo, posted on their Facebook, a group like Etisab would have seen it and then verified it and sent it to the users. And that's what we're trying to do, is just give that leg up to people that we are watching everything, we're monitoring everything, and we just want to provide you that information.
When she was in that attack, it became even more clear to Sarah that the people and the government weren't talking to each other. Without a way to hold officials accountable or keep people safe in some other way, they were out there on their own. And it was from that realization that Etisab was born. Ihtisab means accountability in Dharian Pashto, and that's exactly what it's doing. It gives people the information they need to keep themselves safe when officials can't be counted on. And ideally, at least before the Taliban seized power, it also pushes the government to do a better job at keeping their people safe. I asked Sarah to show me how the platform works.
Okay, so the great thing about Ihtisab is that due to the fact that Afghanistan has slow internet, it's accessible by 3G. So the way that we've designed the website is that it's very, very easy to load. There isn't a lot of gimmicks or anything like that. So people can connect to the report very quickly. And the first thing that you'll see is a map. You click file a report and it provides you with a whole bunch of different categories to click on. So let's say COVID-19. And the next thing you do is you describe the problem. So for example, I would say something like bus is over capacity in Kabul city center, something like that. And what you can do is we can provide you with any updates on your report, and then it tells you that we're thankful for your report.
So basically, Ihtisab allows people to crowdsource safety information. When people post about an incident, it's verified by Sarah's team, and then other users are notified about whatever is going on. But creating this service from scratch was not easy.
The first year and a half, it was, I felt very little hope. I felt like we ourselves as Afghans had very little trust in our capacity, as if we had this minimum basis of expectation for ourselves, and that was the best we were ever gonna do. It was like, we're just gonna get by. We're not made for this innovation stuff. We're not made for this tech stuff. And I hated that assumption. I was like, no, we're not. I mean, we have the youngest youth population in the entire world. 70% of Afghans are under the age of, I think, 20. It's a huge amount of youth. We are the majority.
Despite the challenges, Sarah persevered and launched the platform. Now, Ihtisab allows people to take their safety into their own hands, whether or not the government's willing to help.
And I think that's one of the beauties of tech startups and innovation, is that it does not work within the parameters of government. Not like we're like anarchists, but I mean, we want to keep everyone accountable.
So one of the challenges of Ihtisab now, especially with the Taliban in power, is the question of accountability. When Sarah originally conceived of the idea, she imagined Ihtisab as an app that would allow people to share issues with the government and then hold them accountable to doing something about those issues. But, and this was before the Taliban took power, Sarah found through surveys that what people care most about is their immediate safety. And so that's what the app is focusing on now, which makes sense since there's not much accountability to be had for a government that came to power by force. But Sarah still sees the platform as fundamentally about accountability and transparency.
Ihtisab's mission is democratizing access to information. When we want to democratize access to information, it means that there is a sense of accountability, because you're not just relying on what the government is spewing out or whatever the media organizations are spewing out.
Ihtisab launched back in August, and so far, it's been a huge success.
For example, I had a friend who was going to the northern part of the city, and we sent him a push notification, and it was like, okay, there's been an IED explosion. And he was like, Sarah, I was literally going there. And, you know, when I got your notification, I just turned back. And just that for my team, I mean, that was just like it for the last 2-3 years of work, it made everything just to have that kind of feedback.
Whereas in the US, apps like Citizen and Nextdoor can create an overblown sense of the amount of crime in a neighborhood, Ihtisab provides people with a sense of comfort and security. It gives them the information they need to be safer every time they leave their home.
For me, that would be very anxiety-inducing, an app like Citizen. Whereas with Afghanistan, we've grown up being anxious people. Like, we've grown up being traumatized people. Like, for tech like this in Afghanistan, it's like, we want that information all the time. Like, I want to know, where am I going? What, like, how can I get home safe? Is my family safe? Can I check up on them? Like, we are craving that type of information because there's so much going on that you need to know. Like, for me, the fact that I do this and I see reports probably quicker than anyone else does in the country, it makes me feel at ease because my partner is there and my grandma is there and my aunts and uncles are there and my best friends are there. So the fact that I'm like, okay, this is in an area where one of my friends is, I'm going to call her because now I know. And before, we didn't have that capacity.
Now, Sarah's working on adding functionality. The majority of people in Afghanistan own Nokia flip phones, and so Etisab is developing a feature that can text people safety notifications. And it's clear that this idea isn't a good one just for Afghanistan.
Now I have people on my Facebook or on Twitter who are like, can you even have this app in Pakistan? And I was like, whoa, like I never thought about that. You know, so the potential for growth is so obvious at this point that it just goes to show that you can't give up.
In the past couple of years, what usually comes to mind when I think of tech and innovation is big companies that are out to make a lot of money, no matter what the impact on the world. But Sarah and Etisab are doing something different. They're giving people the tools they need to keep themselves and their families safer, and hopefully to hold their governments accountable to doing their jobs. And if Sarah can do this in Afghanistan, there must be a way to apply this model of accountability to the rest of the world, to help solve small things like rats in the streets and big things like keeping us safer from violence. But it shouldn't be Sarah and Etisab who's holding governments accountable to doing what they're supposed to be doing already. It should be the reverse, governments and the rest of society supporting Sarah and those like her and keeping our city safe and healthy. It was just before the Taliban seized Kabul when I last talked with Sarah. So needless to say, there have been a lot of changes in the country and with the app since then. Now, Sarah is studying human rights and data science at Columbia University, and she spends the rest of her time managing Etisab and adapting to the changing political climate in Afghanistan. For safety reasons, the Etisab team now does all of its work remotely, and Sarah's working to get all of their team members out of the country. Here's what Sarah said at the end of our last conversation, back in August.
Whatever happens, I have to take it as I go. And now my hope, even with the situation right now in the country, is so hopeful because of the fact that I know that our youth want to be like youth in the US, want to be like in Europe or Canada. Like, they want to be on TikTok. They want to be expressive. They want to have campaigns. They want to work on climate change. They want to express themselves through music or whatever it is. They want that. And it's going to be a really difficult time with the Taliban, and because they do have leverage right now. But because the youth are such a majority, like, that's what gives me faith in humanity, is the next generation, is that we're not going to take the status quo and go with that. Like, we're going to change it. And if it means that we have to have a period of instability for that, we're not going to give up.
Sarah was optimistic back in August, and before this episode released, I checked in with her over voice message. She said that the Etisab team is still working hard, and they'll be adding new cities to their map later this week. The team is also actively working to make sure they all stay as safe as possible.
Hi, Benjamin. Everyone at Etisab is doing okay. Our team is safe for now. The majority of them are in hiding. We're keeping their identity secret. A couple of them have been able to relocate to other countries, and we are working steadfast to get the team relocated to other parts of the world.
And though Etisab has had to adapt to some pretty big changes, Sarah says,
I feel optimistic about Etisab. The great thing about technology is that it knows no bounds. And that means that working in the cloud, working wirelessly, means that we're able to do what we can. Obviously, there are extraneous challenges that we were never expecting, but we're going to continue to innovate and do whatever we can to bring about change equitably across Afghanistan through technology.
Of course, the future is still really uncertain. But if Sarah's work says anything about this new generation, then I'm going to follow her lead and feel hopeful too.
این شهر خسته بعد تو کابل نمیشود این شهر خسته بعد تو کابل نمیشود کابل بدون تو تحمل نمیشود کابل بدون
And now for our credits.
This podcast was created on Lenape land in New York and Ute land in Colorado.
Ramin Naqshbandi performed the music that you hear now.
Ramin is one of Sarah's friends. Otis Gray gave us feedback as our editorial advisor and mentor.
Jesse Sheldon designed our cover, and Nick Bluebird Lane designed our episode art.
Nina Durga designed our website, and Metzli Nieves administered our social media.
This podcast is supported by funds from a Creativity and Innovation at Colorado College Student Seed Innovation Grant.
I'm Benjamin Swift.
And I'm Trisha McCurdy.
And thank you for listening to People, Place, Power. To catch every new episode as soon as it drops, be sure to follow the show. You can also follow us on Instagram at People, Place, Power and email us your thoughts at hello@peopleplacepower.com. And if you liked what you heard, be sure to give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps other people find the show. See you next week with our next episode.